Matt Scundo here, and before we introduce this week's guest, I'd like to respond to a few allegations that have been making the rounds. It seems that a website named Miss Snark has been spreading all manner of malicious rumors about me. I'll take some of these disreputable lies one by one. First off, while I did harbor a childhood interest in the circus, I was never a trapeze artist. For one thing, I'm afraid of heights. For another thing, well, there were no female trapeze artists who were willing to break me in. Thus, my brief flirtation with the big top ended at the ripe old age of 16 with a pile of used Kleenex. Do I make myself clear? Second, yes, there was one lonely moment concerning a terrapin, but I assure you that it was consensual. And it's entirely my private business. I don't see why the people here are going ahead and writing about it. Really, have you no lives? There was, of course, the ill-fated attempt to open up a gay bar, when I was told that it was a sure investment that my name would not be involved in any way. Let me put it to you this way. Never trust anyone who claims to work at Goldman Sachs. Finally, well, not really finally, but Bat Primero was indeed my long-lost brother. But again, that's none of your business. Beatrice Segundo was the love of my life, or so I thought. I should also note that I'm very much in control of my deviant strokes. One learns a lot over the years, particularly after that unfortunate terrapin incident. Ooh, Harold, I loved you so. So for those who have disseminated these vicious lies, I've consulted with my attorneys. Let it be known that my people have been in touch with Miss Snark's people, and I think we can count on a six-figure cash settlement, if you know what I mean. Anyway, enough of this. I've got a sophomoric gig here, and I aim to keep it. This week's guest is Jay McInerney. He is the author of several books, including Bright Lights, Big City, and Brightness Falls. In fact, nearly every novel with the word bright in it can be attributed to Mr. McInerney. Most recently, Mr. McInerney has shifted away from this bright motif and authored the book The Good Life. Our young loving correspondent caught up with him during a recent trip to San Francisco. And no, there were no terrapins involved, I assure you.
Okay, so I am here with Jay McInerney. How you doing, Jay?
Very well, thank you.
Yes, so you've been doing a lot of cities, and I guess you saw Brett at Easton Ellis, you were telling me last night.
Yeah, I was in L.A., and saw Brett, had dinner with him. It used to be my regular Friday night ritual, but he foolishly moved to back to L.A. from New York, so
really,
I don't get to see him as much as I used to.
Does he actually call you the Jayster? Or?
Frequently, he does.
Really? Okay. That's the one sort of trivial question I wanted to give you. Well, anyway, I wanted to get to
I call him the Redster.
Yeah.
I'm not really? Sure. I'm not sure who started it. Yeah.
Yeah. Are you going to you're going to have to write him in one of the future books since he wrote you?
I don't know. I think that's his thing, but I actually had him in this book briefly. There's at the dinner party that kind of opens.
Oh, really?
The dinner party that opens the book originally, you know, Salman Rushdie was a no-show at this dinner party. And then I was going to have Russell. Originally in the first draft, Russell says, "Well, I called Brett, but he was too hungover and he couldn't make it." So, and I mean, honestly, Brett's book, you know, Lunar Park was so self-referential and so, you know, kind of in your face, postmodern, this is a different kind of book and a different order of realism, I think, or it just didn't, you know, it's just too cutesy, honestly. I mean, this is not the kind of book that I wanted a lot of sort of cutesy insider jokes in. You know?
Okay, well, we'll get to the wit component.
I mean, I love Lunar Park, but you know, Brett's been stealing my characters for years, and he finally just put me in there too.
He should steal one of his or something. Well, I wanted to talk about actually the September 11th component in The Good Life, and I wanted to find out to what extent is The Good Life a post September 11th or and also pre. examination of our culture, and if so, why the upper class? Do you think that's like sort of the right kind of angle to sort of examine it? Or,
well, I mean, these are the people that I write about, you know. You know, the first draft of my book really had probably a just a more a broader cross-section of New York. And, you know, there was a sanitation worker and a cop that were like sort of main characters. And it honestly felt a little labored to me that way. And the book didn't have a lot of focus because I was just trying to like fit everybody in. And I was trying to do this sort of representative sampling of the city. And I just eventually narrowed it down to the characters I've been writing about all along, you know? I mean, particularly Russell and Corinne Calloway are, characters that first appear in my 1992 novel, Bright as Falls, and I'd always planned to go back to them. I dispute the notion that they're upper class. I mean, these are like people desperately trying to, you know, cling to their rental apartment in New York City. You know, Russell Calloway is an editor in the notoriously underpaid field of publishing, and Corinne is a freelance would-be screenwriter. So, I mean, I take issue with the notion that they're somehow upper class.
Yeah, but they have like a savings from the previous book in Brightness Falls, and, you know, they have this kind of carryover, and they're certainly not like hurting, you know, as much as, say, someone who's living from paycheck to paycheck.
Well, no, actually, I mean, in fact, in the book it says that, you know, they are clinging desperately to their existence in Manhattan. And in fact, you know, anybody who works in the cultural field, whether it's, you know, newspapers or book publishing or something, they are struggling to make ends meet. And in that sense, they're, I don't think they're that different from people who are living from paycheck to paycheck in, you know, slightly less glamorous circumstances. I mean, their lives have a certain glamour component, but they do not have financial security by any means.
Then again, the nature of that financial security is entirely sort of subjective. For one person, it might be just being able to pay the rent and food. For another person, it might be, you know, evening gowns, jewelries, going on the cocktail parties.
Well, indeed, but that's not their life. I mean, that describes the lives of some of the other characters in the book, who really genuinely are in the upper classes of New York society. But, you know, these are the people, basically, that, I mean, whether we're talking about Russell and Corinne, Russell as an editor, as a someone at the center of the New York publishing world, has a, you know, someone who has a hand in shaping the culture, and his sort of rival and counterpart, Luke McGavick, who's a Wall Street figure, a so-called private equity guy. These people kind of run the economy, and I think as such, they're interesting characters, and I think they're worthy of fictional consideration. And all too often, people like this are only dealt with in genre fiction, and the sort of, you know, cheesy popular fiction that sort of takes a sort of voyeuristic view of the wealthy and the powerful. And, you know, I think that, you know, they're highly educated, they're highly self-conscious, and as such, you know, they're at least as interesting as their counterparts lower down on the socioeconomic scale, if not more. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned just before all this that you had, the other sort of characters you had as main characters felt labored to you. I was wondering, was this in the draft before September 11th, or what did you mean by that exactly?
No, this book came into being well after September 11th, and, you know, it was a good 6 or 9 months after September 11th that I started writing this book. What I meant was that, you know, originally my first draft, I was just trying to like show the impact of the city of the event of the tragedy of September 11th, you know, through a huge cross section of characters, and I eventually decided that the book was just too diffuse and it lacked focus, and I narrowed the focus down.
I guess you were trying to sort of go for the panoramic effect that you had in Brightness Falls. Or?
Well, yeah, but I don't know. Finally, this. I was just looking for a narrative focus, and, you know, finally the sanitation worker had to go.
Out with the garbage.
I mean, he was kind of an interesting character, but I ultimately found, I felt it was kind of labored that I was trying to bring all of these people together through this sort of, the medium of this soup kitchen at Ground Zero. And, you know, there was a kind of political correctness that set in around the time of September 11th that That we were all subject to, you know, all firemen are heroes, you know, all cops are heroes, you know, all the people who died in those buildings were heroes. And, you know, and, you know, I really, you know, writing a novel in the 3 or 6 or 8 months, I mean, you know, following the event, it would have been hard to imagine not having a main character who was a fireman, you know?
Yeah.
And I just think that I didn't want to be enthralled to that kind of what was already a stereotype vision of that time and that event, I guess.
Well, you may actually raise a very daring issue in this book, and that is, after September 11th, these characters more or less kind of resort back to their normal lives. At least that's the sort of feeling that I felt, that the trauma manages to sort of disappear and they kind of...
Well, I wouldn't say that. I mean, certainly in the 3 months that I'm dealing with in the book, it's a very heightened state of awareness in a very unusual time in their lives. And, you know, I mean, the two main characters are spending most of that time working in a soup kitchen at Ground Zero. So, you know, hardly the status quo, you know. I mean, not something they would have been doing before September 11th.
It was curious to me that there were actually very little mention of flags in this book, and how everyone raised, put up flags and everything. I found that to be an interesting kind of exclusion. I was wondering why.
Well, you know, again, I felt there were certain honestly cliched. There were certain cliched narratives already of that time that I felt didn't require reiteration, I guess. You know, I mean, there was a certain official version that had already pretty much set in by the time I started writing this book. And I just wanted to revise it a little bit.
Now, there was the New York Times Book Review that went and referred to Norman Mailer's advice to you, which was don't actually write about this until 10 years have passed. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, given the fact that it's obviously less than 10 years, what was the rush to write a September 11th themed book?
Well,
why the rush, basically?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say that 4.5 years is a rush, you know. But I also feel that, you know, 10 years from now, the really unique emotional texture of that moment is going to have faded from memory. And, you know, I was like thousands of other people, I was there, you know. These people were working together almost every night of, you know, for 3, 4, 5 weeks before they actually found themselves in bed together. I don't know. That doesn't necessarily seem like such a rush to me.
Well, it's,
but, you know, this is an extraordinary time. And the pressure of events was, like, extraordinary. This is basically life during wartime. A lot of people, there was a sense then that we were not going, you know, that the next thing would happen, the anthrax, the next attack, that this could happen at any minute, you know. And so I guess there was a certain acceleration to those events. I don't outline my books. I'm never quite sure what's going to happen from one moment to the next, you know. So it's just it really is a question of, you know, it's almost happening in real time for me too. So
okay.
I mean, I'm feeling my way through these events, and so I guess the timing is unconscious.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the style in this book. What was interesting to me about this, as opposed to
What do you think of it?
Well, it's in the back, but, you know, there's a vacuum in the back, so. The style in this book is actually a little bit more, in terms of, like, you know, overt style. It's a little bit more refined or genteel as opposed to your previous books. Like, for example, there is no sort of gossip columnist in this book.
Mm-hmm,
there is no obvious use of, like, second person voice.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if you kind of sort of like wanted to kind of move away from trickery or...
Yeah, definitely.
That,
I mean,
is that your attitude?
Well, for one thing, I mean, you know, in the shadow of an event like September 11th, you can't, you know, some of the kinds of sort of, you know, stylistic pyrotechnics that I relied on and some of the sort of, you know, some of the easier social satire, I just don't think were quite appropriate for this time, for this mood, for the for the subject matter, you know, and you know, there was something about the subject that I think made for a more muted narrative voice, you know. I mean, you know, certainly high comedy was somewhat ruled out. You know, I think there is, you know, there still is, you know, humor and satire in the book, but you know, this is you know, these are the months after September 11th, and you know, the mood clearly was somewhat somber. I mean, sometimes hysterical, sometimes paranoid, but you know, but it was not a moment for, you know, great frivolity, I guess. Mm. So
did the decorum come from your own sort of self-imposed restrictions, or were you, you were talking to me earlier about like how, oh, I didn't want to actually, you know, hit the exact sort of targets, no flags, none of the sort of predictable kind of things. But at the same time, when you're talking about decorum, which it seems to me you are, there is a certain kind of predictability to decorum in that certain things can't be funny and certain things can't.
Well, I'm talking about an overall tone. There's still, I mean, you know, I'm not abiding by anybody's notions of propriety here except my own. You know, I just think, you know, you know, there may someday be a farce about September 11th, but I certainly don't, I really can't see myself writing it, you know, anytime soon, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, although, you know, there are some farcical elements, really, but, no, it's just, you know, it's just a question of, you know, every subject dictates, you know, every subject requires, you know, certain tonal adjustments. And, you know, those are, you know, this time, this place, this subject matter was, you know, was very different than the kind of things, you know, the subject matter of Bright Lights, Big City, for instance.
Yeah. Well, you know, what was interesting to me was that you actually had layered this long lines of like almost a three-act structure, mm-hmm. Which I found interesting because on two levels. First of all, that's obviously the structure of a Hollywood movie, but the events of September 11th could also be stylized as like a Hollywood movie, as mm-hmm. is there's the film adaptation, of course, of, you know, the Graham Greene book,
the Heart
of the Matter. Thank you. And so I was wondering if this was a conscious decision upon your part to, I don't know, subconsciously suggest that this is kind of appearing like a Hollywood movie, or there is some sort of story underneath the story, or
three act structure predates Hollywood by.
Well, of course, it goes back to Plato, yeah, but it's
quite a bit. So yes. No, I mean, I don't think that. I mean, no, I don't think I was. I don't think I was consciously suggesting that. On the other hand, you know, as I said in the book, you know, there were certain elements, there's certain aspects of the scene at Ground Zero that did remind me of a movie set,
yeah.
You know, and, you know, there was a certain kind of self-consciousness, a certain kind of self-importance in the movements of the sort of minor players in the drama, you know. And also, the lighting was a lot like a nighttime movie set. I mean, the whole place is lit up with these huge banks of lights. And
you frequently
there was a sort of a staginess to to the rescue effort, which did strangely remind me of a movie set. Mm-hmm.
Well, you also, you frequently mentioned, like, you know, salmon-colored lights, as well as, I don't know, at the same time, I wanted to go back to the style aspect. Like, there are, there's a very sort of, I guess, layered sort of genteel sort of style in this. Like, for example, you know, Umbiki Mergenser surfaced out of the murk. A sickly apron of lawn that seemed to retain only a dim memory of photosynthesis. It goes almost back to a sort of 1920s, 1930s feel. And I was wondering, to what sort of level did you kind of labor over the prose?
Well, I always labor over that. I mean, you know, I've never written telegraphic prose, you know. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, to some extent, I want to say that's, you know, that's my prose. That's the way I write, you know. I mean, I certainly wasn't seeking to make the prose baroque. But on the other hand, I think that, you know, I think the complex sentences are often able to convey a more vivid and complex impression than simple declarative sentences. And that's, I mean, this is my, I don't know, this is my this is my prose style.
Is it still in any way kind of the Fitzgerald kind of influence, or?
Well, if there is any Fitzgerald influence, I suppose it would be more later Fitzgerald, like Tenderest the Night. I've certainly always been an admirer of Fitzgerald, and I don't know. So, I mean, some people have found Fitzgeraldian elements in this prose. You know, I mean, at this point for me, it's not remotely a conscious operation. You know, I mean, I haven't, you know, read Fitzgerald in several years. Certainly not since I started this book, and I certainly wasn't invoking him. He, you know, he ceases to be quite a, you know, he ceases to be as viable a role model if you pass the age of 44. You know, when he was. When he was dead, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, I suppose to some extent he'll always be there in the background for me.
There are actually two authors that you actually mentioned that I found to be quite interesting. In the moment at the beach retreat, the retreat, where you have all the bookshelves there, you reference both John P. Marquand and James Gold Cousins. And now, this was interesting to me because both of these novelists wrote novels that were written very sort of cleanly, and yet they also dealt with these notions of, like, you know, the middle class, the upper middle class having to make life choices and being sort of bound by their class or their occupation.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
I was wondering if you think The Good Life is kind of one of these books that is maybe meant to fill that kind of gap, because there aren't as many books written in that particular, you know, with that particular ethical dilemma in mind, you know?
Yeah, I suppose to some extent. You know, I think there is a, you know, I think there was a certain type of social novel that was more common at that time. A certain terrain and subject matter, certain thematic concerns that are not very well covered in our time.
But in Marquand's case, it's very interesting because he also made the cover of Time and Newsweek. Mm-hmm. He was also a very popular writer as well. And it's actually kind of a situation not unlike yours, because you're actually doing quite well on the bestseller list I saw with this. So.
Well, happily. I mean, who knows? You know, I mean, it's funny. None of my books have actually been, you know, although Bright Lights, Big City eventually sold, you know, well over a million copies. And none of my books has ever actually appeared on the bestseller list before. This is the first one. I don't know why. It's certainly nothing that I can predict or that I, you know, if you'd asked me, I wouldn't have thought this would be the one that would hit the bestseller list. But on the other hand, I think the popular audience for this book, though, is somewhat limited because, you know, it's not a genre book, and as love stories go, it does not follow the conventional trajectory that translates so nicely into Hollywood filmmaking. And, you know, as you say, I mean, you know, the prose is such, some of those sentences are going to give pause to the less nimble-minded readers among us. So, you know, I think I may be operating at the outer edge of my popular appeal, you know.
But then again, maybe it's...
This is never going to knock the Da Vinci Code off the bestseller list, but let alone, you know, Grisham or whoever else is there right now.
But then again, maybe people are looking, you know, I need sort of a John Updike-y sort of thing. I mean, there are obviously parallels to this and Brightness Falls and Rabbit Angstrom, of course.
You know? Well, yeah. No, it's funny, you should mention the bestseller list, because, you know, as soon as I popped on the bestseller list, and albeit at the bottom, you know, I looked at every single other book on that list is a genre book. I mean, there is no literary... Julian Barnes appeared for a second, popped off. But there was no other literary fiction, nothing that could remotely be called literary fiction on that list. So, you know, I thought, I was kind of grateful to even... It somehow crept on there.
But, like, up
but you know, once in a while, there are popular crossovers, you know? You know, I mean, well, there's, you know, every... I think, you know, the bestseller list and serious literary intent are usually incompatible, but not always. You know, there are books like, you know, I mean, going way back, World According to Garp, more recently, The Corrections, you know, or, you know, various books by Updike and Roth, I think, that have crossed over into the sort of into the area of popular consciousness, you know, and that's and I think that's a, I mean, I think that's the wonderful thing about the novel is that unlike poetry, which just is completely divorced from pop culture, from you know, mass consciousness, that the novel is a mongrel form, and it is, it started out as a popular form. It's not a, it's not some sort of hieratic art form.
I don't know about and, poetry, because Beat's doing pretty good. You know, Allen Ginsberg's Howl is still going really strong.
Well, yeah. Beat poetry, I mean, Jack yeah, Burr, it's right? going strong, but yeah. we're not talking about, like, hundreds of thousands of copies a year. I mean, you know, the corrections in 1 year sold more copies, I think, probably than Howl has in its entire history. But what I'm saying is, yeah, I mean, there's, you know, these occasional sort of, you know, Dylan Thomas or Allen Ginsberg makes a bit of a dent, but the novel regularly become, you know, there is this point of intersection between popular fiction and literary fiction where, you know, you find these books that of serious literary intent that manage to tap into you know, the larger culture and into the imagination of a broad audience, and I think that's a good thing. I mean, Bonfire of the Vanities, another example. Bright Lights, Big City is another. Less Than Zero. These books that are not crime, you know, crime dramas or romance novels. That you know, books that are attempting to extend the, you know, to sort of push the, you know, to slightly push the envelope of language and form and still manage to somehow tap into a larger audience. It's a great thing. And every time somebody declares the novel dead, along comes another one. You know?
But there are also those, like, strange case of midlisters who, you know, who constantly have their novels purchased over and over and over again, yet never actually, like, for example, if you want, well, it's a genre case, but like Terry Pratchett, for example, manages to stay in business because there's like 40 of those books out.
Yeah.
You know, maybe that's a bad example, but I guess, you know, what of the sort of novelists who manages to have like a sort of sizable built-in audience who consistently buys the books? I mean, do you feel restrained by this kind of best-selling notion or the fact that there's...
Well, I'm pleased and amused to find myself on the bestseller list at this point in my career. But I think you know, I it's not something I would ever count on. I guess, you know, because I think, you know, the genre fiction generally dominates the bestseller list. But there are fortunately these happy exceptions. You know, whether you're talking about, you know, Roth or, you know, or Don, you know, I think Don DeLillo's Underworld might have briefly hit the bestseller.
I think it did.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, and this is very reassuring to me, you know, that this sometimes happens.
But simultaneously, the question is, I mean, this book also got a huge push, a huge amount of publicity, I think, by comparison to other authors who might not. Maybe is it a matter of publicity or is it a matter of the book? I mean, you know.
You know, the funny thing is, I don't think anybody really knows. There's a lot of intangibles here. I mean, some people who claim to know about these things say it's word of mouth. I mean, certainly my first book, Bright Lights, Big City, became, you know, started selling 10,000-20,000 copies a week on the basis of word of mouth because there was very, very little press until it had become a real cultural phenomenon. The New York Times didn't review it for 3 months. By the time the New York Times reviewed it, it was, you know, it had sort of permeated a certain layer of the culture. That was an example of a word of mouth phenomenon. I don't know. Some books are made by the New York Times Book Review. I don't know. I mean, I suppose it's possible. I don't think advertising really necessarily make a book. I don't know. You know, I always get a lot of publicity, though. And I don't necessarily always, you know, my last book, Model Behavior, you know, I got a lot of press for that book, and I sold. I mean, already this book has outsold it by 4-1. So I don't know.
But you also
I don't know what it is.
But you also have this cult of personality because you had the Warren St. John style article about you in the New York Times as well, in which
I've always said that stuff though.
Yeah, but I mean, do you think? Are you troubled by the fact that people might buy the book because, like, oh, well, this guy is sort of some
not at all. No, I don't. I'm not sure if that stuff sells books, though, you know? I mean, maybe it does, but I mean, since, you know, for 20 years, I've had, you know, I've had that kind of press about my personal exploits and my, you know, my sort of, you know, what I call the persona of the sort of, I don't know, you know, this sort of bad boy, you know, party animal novelist. That press has always sort of followed me around. I'm not sure if it helps the book sales, though, honestly.
But it seems strange to me that it's lingered for 20 years. I mean, you would think strange that it would, like, too. You know.
I mean, really, I sort of outgrew that. Persona about 10 years ago, but it's you know, it still seems to be something that I have to disclaim. I think to some extent this stuff is distracting. And certainly I think there's a lot of critics who just hate me. Just on principle, because they think that, you know, they hate my persona. They hate this sort of caricature of me that they read about in the gossip columns and in the style section. And they're determined that nobody like that could possibly write serious fiction, you know. And that way, I think it's, you know, it's a bit of a handicap. But, you know, unfortunately, I got stuck with this, like, early on. And it was really a function of my first novel, Bright Lights, Big City, being a somewhat autobiographical novel, and myself as someone who lived in New York, fitting the bill of, you know, basically, I looked like the main character. You know, I looked like the protagonist of that book, you know, and there I was in the media center of the country, you know, where my exploits could be written about. And you know, the media needed somebody like that at that time, just like, you know, they needed Truman Capote in his time, or Fitzgerald, you know. And these are extra literary concerns, you know. I mean, maybe to a certain extent it's good that, it's good when somebody makes the novel look glamorous, I think, you know. I think it's a shame. It's a shame if all the glamour quotient, all the rock and roll quotient is drained out of the literary profession. But, you know, but on the other hand, I think it can be very distracting.
But simultaneously, though, if it's all about glamour and all about rock and roll, literary credibility is not necessarily there.
Well, indeed. That's, you know,
that's got to be pretty troubling for a person who really clearly values language in this book.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Well, you know, it's something that I've had to live down, and you know, something I've been trying to live down for a long time. I mean, you know, I'm not sure that piece in the style section really helped me, but nor did I really know where it was going. You know, I wish that the media were a little more concerned, you know, the mainstream media were a little more concerned with prose style and literary structure, but they're not, you know, and they'd much rather hear about my girlfriends, you know.
I don't know about that, but like Blake Bailey, I'm not sure if you saw the Slate piece on you.
No.
Blake Bailey, who also wrote that Richard Yates biography, but he actually had a very interesting thing to say about your work, about this book in particular. He said that he suggested that you were a lot more enchanted rather than repelled by the rich and famous, and that actually you, that a larger canvas was kind of came at the cost of your wits and as well as your satirical perspective. I was hoping maybe you might be able to comment upon this. Are you attracted or repelled by the upper class?
I mean, well, again, I mean, you know, I object to this notion that, I mean, there's one couple in this book who could remotely, who could qualify as upper class. So I think, first of all, it's a failure of perception when people lump all of the characters in this book together, because a lot of them are from the, you know, the culturati and from the, you know, from the very class that these, you know, people who write for Slate and The New Yorker and everybody else, these are their peers, you know, and I think it's a failure of perception to say that this is a book about the upper classes. There's, you know, exactly two characters in the book who are upper class in any definition of the word. But I think that, you know, the notion that, I mean, satire, I think, is a relatively, it's a relatively limited form. And, you know, I mean, I love Bonfire of the Vanities, but, you know, I don't think that it, you know, I don't think that it had the depth of Balzac's portrait of, you know, his Parisians in the 19th century, because ultimately I think it was merely satire, and that there was no, you know, that this sort of sympathetic, you know, human understanding was lacking, you know? I mean, I don't ever want to write a book about people for whom I have nothing but you know, nothing but disgust. I don't ever want to dwell for, you know, several years of my life with characters that in whose humanity I do not believe. So I think, you know, these characters are both admirable and contemptible in differing measures depending on the characters, and that it's very simplistic to insist on that they're merely one or the other.
I think, though, he was specifically commenting upon how much fun, like, say, Brightness Falls is a very fun book, but it also has this kind of notion of a more human satire, not necessarily a vicious Wolfian sort of satire. Actually, a satire very much along the lines of John P. Marquand, who was known for, you know, like in Point of No Return or the late George Apley. These books are both very much sympathetic to its characters, but they also sort of skewer institutions. And I think that Brightness Falls falls into that type of sort of satirical category, where it's not necessarily satire that's just like, you know, juvenile or something, you know, but satire that is, you know, more kind of, you know, more sort of merging with verisimilitude, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, this is a love story, really. And as such, it's maybe a little bit, and it's also a story about the emotional repercussions of this incredible communal calamity. And I think, therefore, it's simply a very different beast than, you know, than Brightness Falls. I mean, you know, the stock market crash in 1987 was no very terrible, you know, it was no great tragedy, really, in the scheme of human suffering. September 11th was, and as such, it calls for, you know, a different approach, I think. But, you know, not all people who are in Luke McGavick's income bracket are contemptible, you know, and I think that it is a prejudice and a real failing on the part of certain critics to assume that these people must be treated with contempt. I think it's bullshit. You know, I think it represents a very prejudiced, narrow-minded preconception. You know, there's this sort of, you know, there's this real self-loathing on the part of the culture-producing classes, I think. You know, this notion that, you know, that a sanitation worker is somehow more worthy of treatment, of fictional treatment, than a guy who works on Wall Street. Mm-hmm. And I just don't buy it. I think it's bullshit.
Well, then how do you sort of, you know, combat this class chasm where we can, in fact, make fun of a sanitation worker without you necessarily being...
It's hard to make fun of a sanitation worker.
Yeah.
It's politically incorrect.
Yeah.
And it's politically... Likewise, it seems it's politically incorrect to suggest that someone who works on Wall Street might have a heart.
Yeah.
And I think that's... You know, my brother's an investment banker, and I can tell you, he's a human being. I don't feel that he is a contemptible person. And I think that he is an interesting... You know, he and his peers are interesting because, you know, they have a lot to do with, you know, the world that we live in and how it is run and how it is operated. And to treat them merely as caricatures is a mistake. It's very short-sighted.
But, you know, what? They're not the only people who necessarily run the world. I mean, you know.
Well, they don't, but I mean, I don't live in Washington, D.C., and I'm not interested in writing about those people. I'm saying these are my, this is my fictional terrain. I think it's an interesting one.
I wanted to go back.
I mean, to ask somebody to write about every social strata in the world, I think is, I mean, I don't know anybody who's ever done that.
Yeah, that's very true. Very true. Well, and then, of course, you have certain sort of things that you're very good at. You know, every writer has like three or four things that they're good at, and this is definitely one, you know, in terms of what, or that draw them necessarily into something. Going back to this notion of the good life being a love story, I wanted to kind of draw comparisons again with Brightness Falls, where Brightness Falls has, you've got a, you know, corporate take, or you got a takeover of a publishing house, you've got like race-related riots in the street, but this book, you know, I was wondering why you sort of didn't have those kinds of like sort of narrative elements to sort of propel the plot in The Good Life as you did in Brightness Falls.
I mean, because it's a love story? You're just asking The Good Life is a totally different book. And the fact that it has some of the same characters, I wasn't trying to write the same book. I was trying to write a completely new book. And I'll direct you back again to somebody. You know, this is a love story. And as such, that is the narrative, ultimately, you know? It is a love story set in wartime. And, you know, the tools I used in Brightness Falls were appropriate to that time and that place, and I don't think to this time and this place.
Do you find plot to be sort of a burden when writing, or...?
It's not my primary preoccupation in general. But, you know, I mean, plot is important, but, you know, I think, you know, genre fiction is all about plot. Then there's a sort of, there's a sort of prose poem, which is all about mood and language, and I think that, this novel, I think, exists somewhere in the middle of those two things.
Oh, actually, there was actually one motif I wanted to ask you about that I found in a couple of your books. There's this motif of bodies washing bodies. Like in Brightness Falls, you have Corrine's dream of the tongue as a bar of soap.
Right.
And in this, you actually have the sort of incident with Luke in the Turkish bath in Tokyo. And I was really curious about why you think this is kind of cropped up in your writing, this sort of bodies washing bodies. It's very, very specific,
I don't quite know what to tell you about that. I'm afraid you're operating, you know, you've delved into one of those areas of the unconscious reservoir that the writer draws on with unwittingly and unknowingly.
Or dries, for that matter.
Yeah.
Jay McInerney, thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Took a boat or a ferry to an island there were guns and trees and balloons in the sky, and we knew it was right. It wasn't only the light. Rode our bikes up and down the streets so wide. Don't lock them up, no, they'll be just fine. And I said, oh my, my, I can't believe it, I cried. This must be paradise, but it's not, no, no.